water, earth, fire, air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar, and although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end. And like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexities of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. After we concluded our coverage of Avatar: The Last Airbender, we decided to continue exploring the world of bending by first covering the comics, and now we go on a journey with Avatar Korra as she navigates the post-war world.
Last week, Korra and her team busted out the airbenders who were imprisoned by the Earthlane, then headed to the metal-bending city of Zaofu. In Zaofu, we met some new members of the Beifong family and watched as Lin and her sister Sue fought about the past and then reconciled. This week, we'll learn more about what Zaheer and his partners are up to and revisit the Misty Palms Oasis in episodes 7 through 10 of Book 3, Change.
Kinfolk, I forgot to tell you. Some podcasts don't believe in adult content. They think adult content is something you can give or take on a whim. But Kin Folklore knows our people, and that it's essential. Except for Jinora and Kai, they don't qualify. And Tenzin, keep your eye on that kid and keep them in separate rooms. Keep them out of separate rooms, okay, at the Northern Temple.
They're separate dormitories.
This is true.
This.
Yeah, okay.
When Asami moved in, they took her to the woman's dormitory, so...
But that was at Air Temple Island. That was not at the Northern Air Temple. I don't know what the accommodations are like over there. It's not been quite the same for a while. It's been abandoned. So let's find out. Let's make sure. Keep an eye on it.
Okay. All right. We'll keep an eye on them. So episode 7, Original Airbenders. At the Northern Air Temple, Tenzin is giving the new airbenders a history lesson, and they couldn't be more bored.
It's so boring. It's like the guy in Ferris Bueller. Bueller. Like, so bad.
We are very much showing our age by making a Ferris Bueller reference.
Listen, that's a classic.
It is a classic. I love that movie. So Bumi interrupts with jokes, and even Jinora can't help but laugh.
It was funny.
Yeah, he's good. Bumi's funny. When Tenzin does a demonstration ride on Ugi, the new airbenders are finally excited about something. They can ride on a flying bison. And then he tells them that they won't be able to ride until they have many years of practice.
Pour water on all that excitement. Why don't you just, like, you know, just go ahead and forget that. You know, that fire that you sparked, just put it out. It's okay.
And apparently, they also don't have enough bison. You know, bison were endangered. Mm. Poor Appa was the only bison, you know, around at the time, so.
We love Appa.
So, the rest of Tenzin's family arrive from Air Temple Island and tell him that Zaheer had infiltrated the temple and took Guru Lahima's pendant. Korra calls the temple via radio, and I want to finish this point, and then I need to talk about this radio situation.
I knew it.
So she calls to give Tenzin an update to let him know what's going on, and she also gives him a bit of advice about, you know, using Bumi to keep the airbending students a little bit more motivated. So y'all have access to radios. Someone explain to me why Zuko had to get on his dragon and go to the southern tribe to pick up Tonrok and then to the northern tribe to talk to Eska and Desna directly. He couldn't radio.
And not only that, and yes, I'm with you on all of that. Maybe you say, well, it's kind of like not spread throughout all of the four nations and the Fire Nation colonies that are now the Republic, United Republic of Nations. It's just in certain spots. But the Northern Ear Temple's been abandoned for a hot minute. Who went over there and installed a brand new telephone?
It's just, I was just like, what is happening?
It was wild. That was wild to me. Like, I know that they have radio in this world because we know that they were listening to radio, but we never saw it as a communication device. We never saw them like, oh yeah, you could talk through the radio now. When did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen them use it on airships, right?
Okay.
And we've seen the police use them. But, like, a radio that can reach a few miles is really different than a radio that can go from the Earth Kingdom to, you know, the Northern Air Temple. Like, I just...
Plus, anyway, why not just meet in the spirit world? You open the fucking spirit portals for a reason. Like, why not just you and Tenzin fucking meet in the spirit world, okay?
Well, can Tenzin even get to this? He's not Janora. I mean, Janora would probably...
But Janora makes that point later on, actually.
Anyway, listen, I don't want to shade anyone about their spiritual acumen here, but that's not the way to get to Tenzin. The radio is probably the fastest way.
Oh, God, tough look for the guy teaching the next generation of airbenders. Golly. Anyway.
So, Kai and Janora go for a little ride.
What? What's going on here? What? Where's the supervision that I asked for?
They take their little gliders and they go for a little ride. And they come across, you know, a little group of baby bison.
Aww.
Kai goes to say hello, but the mother bison is not okay with someone talking to her baby.
And Janora tried to warn him. She tried to tell him.
Yeah, well, Kai is hard-headed, but anyway. So Janora has to save him, and, you know, their bonding continues. Tenzin takes Korra's advice and asks Bumi for help with some flattery, and Bumi is excited about the opportunity, and then he goes ahead and tells his brother to rule the new recruits of an Iron Fist. Sounding just like Toph at her metal bending school.
Oh my god.
Like it was giving me major flashbacks to Toph. Actually, to Toph, period. This is her teaching style. This is how she treated Aang as well. So in the morning, Bumi quickly regrets this because Tenzin wakes all the recruits up early and then he takes them on a 10-mile hike to break them down and then build them back up.
Ugh.
Then he forces them to meditate to warm themselves with their breathing. Then they have to do a balancing exercise. I mean, he's just relentless. And Janora says to him, I think you might be being too hard on them. Then he shaves the head of one of the recruits and only mentions after the fact that it's optional.
The guy's like, huh? What? He's like, I can't believe I just did that. Isn't it the same dude that was on top of the bridge too? He's taking all the L's.
Yeah. I mean, Tenzin is clearly ganging up on this guy.
Yeah.
Finally, he puts him through an obstacle course, which allows Milo to like intimidate the Melon Lord.
He takes on the identity of the Melon Lord. He's like, this is his best Melon Lord imitation. It's great.
So then Bumi isn't able to get through the obstacle course and he falls and he loses it and storms off. all of the recruits start to complain, and Kai compares this to the Air Queen's prison.
It kind of was a good cop, though. He's not wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was like, well, you know, he's not totally wrong, but what a awful showing for our guy Tenzin here. Annoyed, Tenzin doesn't want to deal with the complaints anymore and tells Jinora to take over. And she's like, well, if I can take over, then can I get my tattoos as a master? And then Tenzin gets mad at her and she storms off, which leaves these poor vulnerable recruits who've just been through a 10-mile hike, forced meditation, an obstacle course, to Milo and Iki.
I mean, and let's, before we get to how crazy that is with Milo and Iki, I want to say Kai really did gas up Jinora, like, yo, I mean, you're a master, you're the best airman I know, you're like better than your dad at like being like in the spiritual world. You could do all that cool airbending stuff, plus you can do all the spiritual stuff. And so when she asks and he says no, she goes in on him about being more spiritually gifted than him, knowing more about... I was like, yo, I was a little triggered. I was like, you know what? This is why you can't have nothing. You know what? You can't get nothing.
Listen, Tenzin is out of order here, though. First of all, your school is boring. No one cares about the dumb history. Like, make it engaging. Why are you teaching them about the history of their people? You have to demonstrate why it's important.
Tenzin's airbending school is like way worse than Tessiah's boring Hogwarts, is what you're saying.
Oh, way, way. Like, wow.
Nothing like, interesting.
Tessiah is is 10 times the teacher that Tenzin
is. Oh, yeah, 100%. But boring Hogwarts was like one of the worst like schools you could go to. And this is definitely trending that direction.
Yeah.
If you don't know what we're talking about, if you've only checked it for Avatar, please go back and listen to our Witcher. We're talking about Aretuza. And the Witcher.
And I'm so glad that we coined boring Hogwarts, because then I saw somebody use it to describe the school in Shadow and Bone, and I was like, ha!
So good.
And so Kai goes to comfort Jinora, and they head back to the baby bison, where they are then attacked and captured by a gang that has caught the bison and planned to sell them in Ba Sing Se, which totally triggered me. Is this not what happened to Appa?
Exactly the same. It's crazy. Why are people just jacking bison? And oh, we find out why they're jacking bison, because the fucking Earth Queen wants to eat them as steaks.
I already hate her. I didn't think I could hate her more. But how can you eat these beautiful bison? They're terrible.
She's got something against animals because of her allergies. And also because of how she was parented and the fact that she took a second fiddle to Bosco. But you know what? We find out something about that too. What do we find out about this?
Listen, allegedly.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
She also ate Bosco.
I can't
Should
even.
We pour one out for Bosco?
We gotta. Let's take a minute and pour one out for Bosco, the guy who should have been in the line of succession and fucking taking the throne. This is craziness. She fucking ate her competition. Like, you know, we do not jail our fucking political opponents so we can beat them. Like, what is happening?
You know what? Bosco probably had more leadership experience than her dad. So
he was at every single negotiation. He was there. He ate all the food. He hung out with all the leaders. He knows where the bodies are buried. How the fuck did she become the queen? You know how? She ate the fucking comp. That's what happened. She ate the bear. Craziness.
I just want to say, we don't know if this is true.
I mean,
allegedly, she ate.
Why would this guy lie? He's like, hey, the queen loves bison, and he's like, and It's rumored that she even ate her dad's bear. Like, why would he lie about that? It's crazy. It's so crazy. I can't.
Oh, Eddie.
Fucking ate Bosco.
So Tenzin, after this interaction with his daughter, Tenzin also needs a little pep talk, and Pema provides that. Afterward, he approaches Bumi to apologize, but Bumi's not about to hear it. And one of the recruits tells Tenzin that Jinora left on her glider with her boyfriend.
Boyfriend? Jinora! I'm feeling like I'm not liking this. I told him to keep him in the separate rooms. He should never picked him up. Should have left him over there and gave him and turned him over to the cops.
Sorry. So Jinora decides that she's going to ask for help from the spirits and sends one to find Boom June. And poor Boom June is listening to Boomy complain. It's like therapy. It's very cute, but it's, I was like, I don't think Boom June actually cares about any of this.
No.
When the spirit arrives and tells him that Jinora is in trouble, Bumi tells the other airbenders and rallies them to go rescue Jinora, Kai, and the bison. Kai manages to bust out of his cage. You know, he's got those street skills that help come in handy. But he gets caught immediately. And just then, another one of the airbending recruits comes to the rescue. But the gang leader is able to drive off with Jinora and most of the bison. And Kai follows on his glider. And then Tenzin, who's just kind of been riding Ugi around looking for Jinora, intervenes. And the other wild bison join in. And the gang leader ends up surrendering.
Yeah. As he should.
Afterward, this was like a dope scene.
It
like,
was great. It brought the airbenders together. Yeah, I love it. Sorry.
Yeah, the bison like joining in to fight. It was just really, really cool. And you know, like new groups, anyone who's ever joined like a new team at work or like been part of a team that was just formed, you know that you really bond around that first crisis.
Agreed.
Around the time, that first time that the copier isn't working, or your project isn't going to get in by the deadline, or like all your work gets lost on the cloud or the server, that's when y'all bond. And this is what's happening with the airbenders. And it's cool to see. And it's also nice to see Bumi take on a leadership role again.
Agreed. And it's happening with the benders, but I think it's also happening with the benders and the bison, because the bison see that they are not like other humans who have been trying to capture them, which could have been why they were so protective in the beginning. They see that they're really trying to save them and help them. And that bonds, that starts creating the bond between the bisons and the benders the way it used to be, which is really fascinating to see too. Yeah.
So later, Tenzin tells Bumi that he's proud of him and they make up. And he then also goes to make up with Jinora. And he promises that he will think about getting her tattoos. That his hang up is just, he's not sure she's old enough yet.
Exactly.
That's how the episode ends.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
She's not old enough for these tattoos. She's not old enough to be running off in the mountains on secret missions with Kai. Although I will say I was very impressed with Kai. And once Kai caught up to the guy, he mollywopped him for even thinking about hurting the bison or Jinora. And not in that order. So I will say he has some qualities I appreciate.
Yes, I was skeptical about Kai too, but Kai has proven himself. And I think now we should give him a chance to woo Jinora.
Yeah, and what I do love about them, I do love this part about them, is seeing Jinora and Kai, even though they're both airbenders, it gives you like a little bit of a flashback, more so than even just seeing the siblings, to like the original series. It just does, because they're young, they're flying around with gliders. It just makes you think of Aang, it makes you think of Katara, it makes you think of Sokka. It's just really cool. So back in Zaufu, Korra and Bolin are training with Su's sons Wei and Wing. Korra is getting better, but Bolin is not getting better. he's having some hard time. At dinner, Bolin and Opal begin to say goodbye. Bolin seems upset. He's not getting metal bending. Opal's like leaving. They were just getting to know each other. But
he hates the future.
He hates. I hate the future. What the hell is that?
I love how Opal is so unconcerned, though. She's just unbothered. She's like, I'll see you when you come back, right? Like, why are you getting all upset?
Yeah. Opal is like, you're going to be coming over to the Northern Air Temple. Like, what are you tripping for? Like, listen, we both have to, like, be on our progression or this is not going to work. I like Opal's whole attitude. She's good for Bolin because Bolin's a little bit too. He needs. Because remember, we said Bolin can be emotionally manipulative. Even though he's a good dude, and mm-hmm. she's able to see through that shit. Like right away, she goes, oh, well, you know what? I guess we'll have to eat a lot of kale. Cause he was like, every time I eat kale, I'll think of you. And she's like, well, I guess we'll have to eat a lot of kale. Meanwhile, Mako's hearing none of these conversations because they've put my boy at the kitty table. Okay? He's over there.
He's sitting next to Aiwe, right?
Yeah.
And Aiwe, he's like, it's so boring.
Yeah, he doesn't know. And he's like, I mean, not that it's boring because of sitting next to you. And he goes, oh, you know I'm lying. Oh, man. Varric comes in and he showcases another one of his useless inventions. He's sitting at the table, an airbender finder, which would be pretty cool because they're looking for airbenders, except the person has to airbend for you to detect it. So if you're looking for people who are airbending who may be hiding the skill, they have to show you the skill in order for you to detect it. It makes this is the worst. This may be one of his worst inventions.
Yes, it is. I love when Asami is like, it doesn't work. She's just like, this thing is not, she's literally pointing it at Korra and nothing has happened. Well, she has to airbend in it, duh. Okay. See, this guy should be in prison. Anyway, go on.
Oh, God. So, Opal leaves that evening and the others prepare to leave first thing in the morning. But that night, Zahir and his gang sneak in. Pabu tries to warn Bolin, but he ignores him. He's like, I'm sleeping, bro. Like, we got to talk about this. They tranquilize both Naga and Korra and capture her. It was not okay with seeing Naga get hit with a tranquilizer dart.
They use like six on her.
And Pabu finally wakes up Bolin, and he and Mako see them running off with Korra and face the kidnappers. The entire compound is put on high alert, and eventually Lin, the guards, and others manage to contain them in metal. But Kazan uses lava to keep the metal benders away from them while they're trying to escape. Crazy. What a crazy thing to see that.
Yeah, this whole like battle is so
cool. It really is. It really,
both sides are doing their very best to win. It's crazy. Great.
So Sue has an idea. She says, she looks up, she sees that they haven't closed the domes that the city is like enclosed with, and she says, if someone can stun the combustion bender, then they'll have a moment where her and Lin can drop in from the top of the dome and rescue Korra. Mako volunteers Bolin. In a classic scene, Bolin's like, I do? I can? I will? Like, they like telling him what he's going to do. He's like, okay, cool. I'll do it. And so Bolin isn't able to get a clean shot right away, but they still go in, mishearing Mako's cue on the radio. So at the last minute, Bolin does pull it off and hits Pully and stuns her, so that it gives them enough time to go down Sue and Lin and grab Korra. Zahir tries to get to her, but Sue takes out his wings, and Zahir and the gang are like, they failed, and they manage to get out of there and escape. So now that, right? What a scene. What a freaking scene. So Aiwe questions all the guards now, because they realize this had to have been an inside job. And Varric and then Sue are questioned as well. At Lin's insistence, she questioned Sue, by the way, which is crazy. Sue's like, no, I'll do it. It's fine. Whatever. He finally finds someone who is lying, which is a guard named Hong Lee. Ai Wei basically suggests that they search his room and they'll probably find evidence that of him helping Zaheer. Ai Wei suggests that they give the guard more time before they get to talk to him once they actually go through and find the stuff there. But Mako's suspicious of this guy. He's like, wait, why are we waiting to go talk mm-hmm. to this person? And Mako tells the others about his suspicions, which honestly were solid suspicions. When you're saying, hey, this guy's 18 mm-hmm. years old. How did he gain connections to these people? Those guys were in jail for 13 years. Who was his connection to them? And this timeline doesn't add up. Real cool stuff. At that point, Varric chimes in and he's like, agrees with what they're saying and kind of lays out what he would do to set them up, to which Mako's like, kind of like what you did to me. Awkward moment where Varric is like, yeah, kid, exactly like what I did to you. So Mako tells him he thinks Ai Wei was part of the conspiracy. And they go to Ai Wei's place to search it out. And they find a secret passageway. Another fucking secret tunnel. Like, these guys love a secret tunnel. So Ai Wei comes back and catches them in his study. He's like, what are you guys doing here? You know, like, I'm a high-ranking official. You know, it's a crime to be inside here. You better explain. So Korra confronts him and offers them some tea. Doing a very bad Iroh impression right now, like nefarious Iroh. And an opportunity to speak. Predictably, he turns on them and, you know, he like sees that they kind of are onto him, and he turns on them and he escapes, telling Korra she has no idea what's coming for her. Wow, that's not ominous at all. That's like a little scary. And as they get through, you know, Korra metal bending, and they're like, come on, come on. She's like, hey, guys, I just learned how to metal bend. Like, calm the hell down. Let me figure this out. And as they go through, a bomb is set off. But Korra protects them by air bending to protect the shrap and the fire and everything that came off from the bomb. Lin and Sue arrive after hearing the explosion, and Korra tells them that Ai Wei was the traitor. Lin is distraught. Since that was her closest advisor. Yo, the Earth Kingdom, they pick some really trash people as their like number one advisors and normally ends up going south. Think about the Earth King in the original series. It's really rough. So Korra says that they have to find them and she wants to use Naga to track him. But Lin wants to take Korra back to Republic City. So Sue tells Korra, listen to Lin. And Korra agrees reluctantly, but later that night, Sue pulls some back channel, I lied on the floor of Congress ass move, and tells Korra, hey, you know what? Here's the keys to my Jeep. That was like, I felt like that was like a Beanie Man. Sima, who got the, anyway. And so she says, here's some supplies, my Jeep. I want you guys to go after Ai Wei. So they can bring him back to face justice. She sounds like she's pissed. She's mad at this guy. She trusted him. And basically that she lied to Lin to get them more time. And that's how the episode ends. And they're like, they're going to go after him.
Yikes.
Sue, I'll handle Lin.
Yeah. Okay, Sue. I mean, sending teenagers to go pursue a fugitive who you... Okay, listen. I'm gonna leave my suit.
Yeah. We got some stuff to unpack about her skills here as a leader.
Episode 9 is called The Stakeout, and Team Avatar is pretty successful in tracking Ai Wei to an Earth Kingdom village. They find that they are also being tracked by the Queen. There's wanted posters of their faces all over the place.
You mean it's not like a poster for a new Movers movie? Like with Nuk-Tuk?
Well, I love how Bolin is just assuming, oh, look, I'm a celebrity. No, you're a wanted man. There's a bounty on your head. So they make a quick exit. They eventually find Ai Wei's Jeep, and Bolin and Mako decide that they're going to go investigate Misty Palm's oasis.
Why? Why don't people skip this place on the tourism map? It's the worst. Misty's Palms has been the site of some of the worst shit that has happened in this series, along with Ba Sing Se. But Misty Palms is really high on the list.
So they put on a couple of disguises is like a really like
they're yellow ponchos.
Yeah, it's just not the right word here. It disguises. They just put on some yellow ponchos
and like aviator glasses, thing. Like ski, like those glasses, like big ass, like goggles and yellow ponchos. Oh my god.
I mean, I guess they look like tourists. I don't know. I don't know what to say. So they get down to Misty Palms, and it seems to be having similar issues as Republic City with the spirits. The spirits are, like, trying to hang out, and they get kicked out of a tavern. It's like, nah. Things are not going super well in Misty Palms. So in Zhao Fu, Lin is waiting for everyone so that they can leave when Sue tells her that, you know, Cora's gone. Cora went to find Ai Wei, and Lin is so pissed at her sister.
I mean, as she should be. She double-crossed her.
Understandably.
Yeah.
But things are not going so bad. Asami finds a clue in Ai Wei's Jeep. It's a note that requests that the recipient rendezvous with the writer at Zai Bao's Grove after sundown. Back in the city, after running from... Well, is the Oasis a city? Village?
I mean, it's a shithole. Whatever you want to call it. It's like, I don't know what to say other than like, I mean, it was dead to me the minute that the slime that set up Appa were associated with that place. Like, I need that place to like, so many bad things. So many. Just go ahead. Continue. I'm sorry. Even in the comics, bad shit happened there.
Well, no, that's not true. Grand got married there. That's good, right?
Well, that's true. She had her honeymoon there? Was that her marriage or her honeymoon?
Oh, I don't remember. But, I mean, Paku didn't like it.
Paku? The accommodations were shitty. All right, see? Paku's on our wave. He knows the vibes. Go ahead, continue. I'm just out on the Misty Palms.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you, as am I. So, back in Misty Palms, after running from bounty hunters, Bolin and Mako find Ai Wei at an inn. They report back to Cora and Asami, and they agree that they're going to stake out Ai Wei's inn and follow him to Zaheer, which is, you know, Mako's plan, because Cora was ready to just go and bust some ass.
Yeah.
They try to check into the inn, but the bounty hunters turn up, and it turns out they actually aren't bounty hunters. They are fans of Nuntuk.
So Bolin was right after all.
And they just want Bolin's autograph.
Oh, it's so good. Which helps them get a room, by the way, because she was shutting them down. I'm like, I'm not letting teenagers stay in my inn. You guys...
And then she's like, oh, you're a mover star?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
In the room, Mako and Cora are all about watching Ai Wei and actually, you know, staking out. But Bolin and Asami decide that they're going to play Paisho. And they can't even agree on the rules.
No.
Like, they have two different ways of playing. Cora wants to use muscle to get Zaheer to talk, but Mako says surveillance is the best strategy for dealing with him. Mm. So they watch for hours and nothing happens. And then Cora finally loses her cool, as Cora usually does, and walks over to Ai Wei's room. But what they find is that instead of leaving to go to this rendezvous, he's actually meditating. And Cora realizes that the meeting is not in the physical world. It's actually in the spirit world. Mm. So Cora decides to follow him through meditations while the others stay in the room to watch over Cora and Ai Wei's physical bodies. In the spirit world, Ai Wei and Zaheer are arguing. Zaheer basically calls him a loose end and tosses Ai Wei into the fog of lost souls.
Ugh, rough, man. Golly, what a tough move. Like, because we've been there. We've seen what the fog of lost souls looks like. That's just rough, man. Golly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel bad for Ai Wei, but it's really tough. I mean, Cora tries to stop Zaheer, but it's too late.
Yeah.
So when he returns to Cora, he agrees to answer questions. But while he's distracting Cora in the spirit world, he sends his minions to Misty Palms Inn to get her physical body.
Okay. So there's going to be a lot of wild points that we're about to go over about what's happened here. But the main thing I want you to take away from this, this is not the most important point, but I do want you to take this. For weeks, we've been railing about the shittiness of the White Lotus. And Zaheer actually says something here that I agree with. After the 100-year war, the White Lotus lost its purpose. Now, what he goes to say about losing their purpose, I don't agree with. I think it's a terrible take. But man, have they fallen off. They fell off, Like, we've seen them get dragged so much. I just want to say, the White Lotus, man, it's not been a good run.
No, it hasn't been. So, he tells Korra that he and his gang are members of the Red Lotus. Mm. Their origins begin with the White Lotus. The White Lotus had, you know, has more purpose than serving the Avatar, in his opinion. A member of the White Lotus, Zai Bao, had broke from the Lotus and began his own society. Kidnapping Korra as a child was actually Unalaq's idea.
Wow.
He was a Red Lotus member. And they were trying to take Korra so that she could open the portal and, you know, bring back Vatu when she was a little kid. Their mission is to restore balance to the world by bringing spirits back. But that's only the beginning. They also want to eliminate nations and governments. And he tells her the natural order is disorder.
Yeah, because she questions like the whole thought process around just like, yeah, I want to bring balance too, but our ideas are different. And I don't think killing like government officials, it will create chaos. And that's his response to it, because he makes points that to the rational mind, if you're not looking deeper as to what he was willing to do to get there, his end result of like, hey, these governments are oppressive, the monarchy is wrong, he actually shares those thoughts with like Sue. Like, so it's like this, those match up. But how he wants to get there is the problem. It's really not about what he's saying. It could be like, hey, we need to reform. And I also think that like this idea that the White Lotus was part of the problem now because they helped the Avatar in the end to end the 100-year war, I mean, that's some flawed thinking if I ever heard it. Like, that's wild.
I do think that, like, okay, let's go back to when we learned about what the White Lotus was in the, you know, the final few episodes of Avatar. At that point, we believed that the White Lotus was this group that had philosophies about, you know, like, practice and honor that cross nations, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what he's saying here is that it became too focused on helping and supporting the Avatar, that they had a mission that went beyond, you know, essentially being the Avatar's bodyguard.
100%.
I totally understand and totally agree with him there. I think where he goes wrong is with the whole Vatu stuff. And, you know, also just like we already know Unalaq was a bad guy.
Yeah.
And that he was going to plunge the world into darkness. So, you know, I think, and Zaheer agrees that Unalaq had selfish reasons for wanting to do this, but like the overall mission of eliminating nations and uniting the world in some kind of weird spiritual, you know, balance is that's what he wants. And it's a little, we'll talk more about this later, but I find, as attractive as Zaheer's rhetoric is, it's short-sighted.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that where the places where he mainly had the issue with was what you're talking about, how the White Lotus operated. Wan's separating of the battle between Vatu and Rava, he felt like that should have continued just to keep the natural order of things of like good and evil, yin and yang. And then I think the third part of what he was saying is that he felt that Unalaq, like his selfish mission to become the Dark Avatar, that was nothing. That had nothing to do with their mission. So he was betrayed by Unalaq too. So we know that this guy, I mean, they have different missions, even though they were connected at one point, you know?
So, Team Avatar sees Gazan and Ming-Ha, you know, on their way to the inn to get Korra, and Mako tells Asami to get Korra out of there while he and Bolin fight them. They basically tear up the inn. I hope the inn has good insurance, because it's... I mean,
I hope it doesn't.
They just...
I hope they don't rebuild. I hope it's just a dune. Let's stop with this.
They just destroy it. Like, Ming Hao basically, like, smashes up all the buildings. Their Gazan uses lava. It's just a mess. Like, it's just destroyed. She manages to capture Bolin and Mako while Gazan pursues Asami and Korra. But Asami and Korra are actually captured by an earthbender. And when Korra awakes, she and Asami have been captured by the Earth Queen's forces. The Red Lotus, though they failed to get Korra, they say they're going to hold on to Mako and Bolin because they can use them as leverage instead.
Yuck. So, the queen's back at it. Long live the queen. Long may she reign. That's the name of the episode. Long live the queen. And Korra and Asami are loaded into an airship. And Korra tries to tell her captors about the Red Lotus and Zaheer's plans. And she's like, he's really crazy. And the guy's like, you're talking about spirit world and plans to overthrow governments. You sound crazy. So he's not buying it. Meanwhile, the Red Lotus transport Mako and Bolin to Ba Sing Se in a truck. Bolin decides that he wants to make friends with Gazan and Mingwa. He wants to...
Everybody.
Yeah.
Just wants to be friendly with everybody.
Yeah. He's like asking him about how it was in prison. He gives what kind of games they played. They tell him. And he's like, you know, plays two truths and a lie. You know, like, it's kind of crazy. Like, it's really wild. In the airship, though, back on the airship, Asami figures out how to free herself and then goes looking for a way for them to break out. But she does this by shading the Cabbage Man, which I kind of co-sign. Listen, the Cabbage Man pulled himself up from a cabbage vendor to an industrialist. But obviously, shoddy workmanship is what she says as she pulls off the metal bar off the wall of his airship. Moving on.
Wow. Team Avatar will never be an ally to the Cabbage Man.
Never. Never. It's crazy. So the Red Lotus asks for a meeting with the queen in Ba Sing Se. Using Mako and Bolin as evidence that they mean well, she agrees to meet with them because they say they have information about the location of her, quote, her airbenders. Zaheer asks the queen to turn over the Avatar, and, you know, she's like, why would I do that? And he tells her that to avoid an international incident where she would come under fire from all the nations, he would basically take the Avatar and keep her off the hot seat, and the queen, and then he would provide the location of the airbenders. The queen finds these terms agreeable and sends Mako and Bolin to the dungeon, like, you know, Luke Skywalker, Jabba the Hutt style, by just opening a trapdoor underneath him. Asami's plan works, and she's able to free Korra. They take back the airship, but they fly right into a sand dune, and the airship's damaged as it crashes. They find themselves in the desert, and while they negotiate with the crew, they see something moving in the sand. Like, yeah, bad time to get caught out in the middle of nowhere. In the Earth Queen's prison, though, Mako tries to encourage Bolin to metal bend. You can do it, bro. Come on. All the prisoners join in. They're chanting. They're like, go, go, go. And it doesn't happen. He fails.
I actually really thought he was going to be able to do it. Yeah. I was like, yes, he's finally going to step up and be able to do it. This is the moment. He failed. Never mind.
Yeah, I love that. I love that they didn't let us have that moment, because it kind of got you to be like, oh, okay, wow, he does have some limitations. Everybody, every hero isn't going to be able to do this stuff, you know? So that was cool. It sets him up to keep trying. So, Lynn tracks Team Avatar to where they left their jeeps and radios Tanrok to meet her at the Misty Palms. Korra and Asami manage to repair the airship that with the help of the crew, but after all that work, a sand shark basically eats the ship. he's hungry. Sand sharks got to eat. They decide to use the scrap metal to create a sand glider. Good thinking. I like the way they're thinking.
Asami is brilliant.
Yeah.
Like Asami she's always going to find a way.
Yeah. And I think this is the first time I heard them. Maybe they have before actually officially call her an engineer. So it's pretty solid. Like to hear that's mm-hmm. that's like her mm-hmm. title. So in Ba Sing Se, the Red Lotus overhear a Daily agent telling the queen about the crash. Sahir decides it's time to make Korra come to them rather than chase her. They go into the throne room, and the Earth Queen is like, "Who let this riffraff in here? Why are they in my throne room?" And attempts to have them arrested and use it as leverage to tell them that, you know what, just busting in here is an offense. Maybe he should just tell her where the airbenders are. Zaheer's having none of it. The whole crew fights the Dai Li and win easily. They wreck him. And then Zaheer airbends the air out of her lungs. Like, talk about using airbending for evil. Wow. So he airbends the air out of her lungs and suffocates her while giving a pretty dark speech about how he doesn't believe in queens. Doesn't believe in he doesn't believe that somebody should have the right to take away people's freedoms and give them back, that she feels that she has the power to do that, and he doesn't believe that she has the power to do that. And, you know, while I don't agree with what he does, valid point. She's not a great ruler. It's like, you know,
should we pour one out for her though?
Not at all. Not a drop.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm good.
Not a drop. Like not even the bad stuff. Like there's some people that just, you know, it's like, you know what, we don't advocate this, but it's fine. It's, you know, bad things happen all the time. The queen is gone, and Zaheer goes to the radio room because he wants to put out a message, and they get ready to rough him up a little bit. Meanwhile, like, hey, you're gonna rough him up, and he's like, no, we want to help the people here. And he does this whole like I'm of the people routine, and the guy says, yeah, I want to help him. Turns on the radio and he lets them know that the Earth Queen has been taken down by a group of revolutionaries of which he is a part of. He won't tell them his name because his name is not important, but that the city is no longer held by oppressive tyrants, and that they are basically free to decide what they want to do with Ba Sing Se. And Ghazan destroys the walls around the city with lava, and Ba Sing Se descends into chaos. People are,
you know, absolute chaos.
Yes, yeah, absolute chaos. Mako tries to melt the metal in prison, but he realizes he can't do it with firebending. And he tries to get Bolin to metal bend, and he thinks he does it, but this time it's just Zaheer opening all the cells.
So, all the cells except for theirs.
Except for theirs, exactly. So Zaheer basically tells them that he has a message for Korra, and he's going to give it to them, to give to her. Back in the Misty Palms, Asami and Korra get on a sand glider, and they glide through the sand to get to the Misty Palms and barely escape getting eaten by a sand shark. And then they reach the Misty Palms and they see that Tanrok's there. There's a dragon there that would mean maybe Zuko's here and Lin is here, and they're all in the tavern. And that's where Korra and Asami hear the news that the Earth Queen has been killed and Ba Sing Se has descended into chaos.
End of an era for Ba Sing Se.
I mean, it's been a long, long way and a long time coming. You know what I mean? Like, the Outer Ring, the way the people live there, it's really heinous. And this family has ruled in an oppressive way for quite a long time. And, you know, I don't think we're not going to condone like killing somebody. Obviously, Zahir's acts are heinous, but removing her from power was definitely something I think was probably needed in that embossing set. You know what I mean? In the kingdom.
Yeah, I mean the fact that the other world leaders allowed her to continue as she was is not a great look for them. I don't think. Again, assassinating her is terrible, yeah. But like. She was a horrible, repressive, oppressive leader. It's just she imprisoned the airbenders. She obviously didn't care about the people of her city. She was overtaxing people. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're not pouring anything out for her, but we are going to talk about... let's start with the Red Lotus and the points that they have about tyranny of governments and nations. We spoke about it a little bit, you know, because we've seen throughout the show that leaders really have a tough time with the governments they have in place, and it's very unclear. There's fire lords, there's queens, there's councils, and there's presidents. So there's all these different forms of governments throughout the entire world. You know, even Tenzin doesn't always consider the freedom and independence of the airbenders. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a consistent problem on the show. And a lot of the balance, the talk of balance, it is because of the type of oppressive leadership that exists in this world. I mean, between the colonization of some of the Earth Kingdom under Sozin and then Ozai's rule, between the fact that like there's this Bender supremacy issue, mm-hmm. that kind of keeps coming up every so often. Obviously, the Earth King is oppressed. We have, you know, issues with the Northern Water Tribes leadership, or previous leadership, I should say, because, you know, I'm a big fan of King Desna and Queen Eska. This is an ongoing theme with the show about abuse of power and leadership. And I'm not 100% sure that the show knows exactly where it lands on should there be kings and queens? Should we even have monarchies? Should one person lead? Is democracy working in the People's Republic? What do you think that the president is doing a good job?
No, not at all. And I actually think that the president is president in name only. There doesn't seem to be any system that tells you when he will be voted out. There's no checks and balances. He, again, the chain of command is him to the freaking chief of police. Like, there is nothing that tells me that he's just not a king and that people call him a president. You know what I mean? Like, he feels like a king still. So I think the show really is unclear on where they land about monarchies, government styles. And I think that's one of the things that I hope that they will clarify as they move down the road on creating more content, because they give each of these things different names, but they're all essentially dictatorships.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the United Republic is supposed to be a democracy, and it sometimes does behave that way. But since the council is no longer a thing and they have a president, it does now seem like he's basically just in charge and he doesn't really have to consult with anyone. And even with his low approval rating, he doesn't seem that concerned. You know, so it's just the leadership is the poor failed leadership and the inability to trust the leadership of the various nations is the reason that the Red Lotus has a compelling argument.
Yeah.
Because if you can't trust the governments, then why should you live by their rules?
Yeah, it's fair. It's totally fair. I mean, like, when you look at And they're not on the side of like Ozai and all these other guys either. They're saying that those guys are failed also. They're just saying that, you know, they believe, I mean, they're a little bit, it sounds like they could have a little bit of anarchist in their doctrine, right? Like, you know, like anarchy as mm-hmm, part of their mm-hmm. doctrine.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, they, to me, I understand where they're going with it. I think this, you know, going a little meta, I think the show does need to determine, okay, what are the systems here? How do people rule? What is the, you know, and obviously the Avatar is the main focus of the show. But one of the things that the Avatar, the reason the Avatar exists is to be the bridge, yes, between the spirit and the human world. But it's also, you know, without, I just won't spoil anything about previous works or like previous timelines in the world. I would just say that, like, it's not unheard of for the Avatar to be in the middle of political squabbles and to have to sort out and keep balance between governments. And so the answer about what is the government structure in these different places really does matter, because it really does impact the Avatar and how they proceed and comport themselves throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's you know, we've talked about, I mean, you know, I don't wanna give, you know, my full Airbnb comment about the Misty Palms Oasis. I think I've left my review. I'm not
one star, staying. Will not book again.
And I do want to talk a little bit about this dynamic again, just carrying over from the previous episode of Sue and Lynn. And Sue lying again after they're just getting to the point of trying to rebuild trust is a really rough, rough kind of like way to start things off.
Yeah, Sue is a... I just don't like the way that Sue hand waves Lynn's genuine concern. So Lynn is actually concerned for Korra's life, because mm-hmm. Lynn actually has some information about the threat that is pursuing Korra. And Lynn also, I mean, Sue should too, because she just literally faced these people, right? She just helped Lynn rescue Korra from the Red Lotus. So the fact that she is fine with Korra, Mako, Bolin, and Asami just going off deeper into the Earth Kingdom to pursue Aiwei is very irresponsible. But furthermore, the fact that she lied to her in front of her sister about it, and basically to buy time, and then gave them the supplies to escape, you could look at that as Sue saying, like, okay, well, they're young people, but they're competent. You know, Korra's the Avatar. You know, it could be similar to how Korra, when she left the Southern Tribe, Katara was one of the people who wished her well, right? Mm-hmm. But the problem I have with it is that Lynn actually knows a lot more about the threat, and Lynn is just trying to protect Korra, and it makes me deeply uncomfortable with how much Sue is just kind of willing to hand wave her sister's concerns away. And furthermore, Sue just has this, like, general sense of downplaying things that are important to her sister.
Yeah.
Like, she just, when the whole incident with Varric came up, she just kind of like, yeah, well, Varric made mistakes in the past, but he's not that person anymore. It was like 6 months ago.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. I mean,
you know, and then when she's talking to her sister about the things she did as a kid, she doesn't fully take responsibility for them. She's like, well, I was a different person. No, not really. I mean, you were a more immature person for sure, and you've grown since then, but you still have to take responsibility for the things that you've done. I don't know. Sue, I like Sue as a character. I think she's great, and I think, like, I really look up to the way that she parents her kids in a lot of ways. Like, I think that in a lot of ways she's a very compassionate mother. When Opal came to her and said, I wanted to go, mm-hmm. I want to go, She was like, okay, you should go. She can reflect on the fact that she parents the opposite of Toph. But there are certain things about Sue that just really bother me. And this, I lied because I didn't agree with you.
Yeah.
It just rubs me entirely the wrong way, especially after what you made the point that they're just trying to rebuild trust together.
Yeah, they're just trying to rebuild trust. And I was about to like compare it to something in Game of Thrones, but I've been told by you and some of our listeners that since we're not a spoiler podcast, I keep spoiling Game of Thrones. So I'm not going to say it because
I think at this point our listeners are used to the Game of Thrones spoilers.
I know. I feel terrible. I feel terrible every time. I'm just like, oh man. But I just get passionate about it, and there is crossover. But I will leave that part out because we can definitely discuss this further when we get to down the road in this show. There's going to be a time to talk about the Beifong and the rebuilding of trust and all that. But I do want to lean a little bit in this week's White Lotus segment into kind of like looking at the failed leadership of this world. And why don't you talk a little bit about like what your thoughts are as far as like what we've seen and what the consistent thread throughout the Avatarverse being, you know, corruption and failure in this area.
Mm-hmm. So I think we've talked a little bit about this already, but like I just want to highlight some of the storylines and the leaders that we've been introduced to in the Avatarverse. In both shows. So we have Sozin, who becomes so obsessed with spreading the Fire Nation's power that he ordered the genocide of the Air Nomads, also killed his friend, mm-hmm. and colonized parts of the Earth Kingdom, plunging the world into a 100-year war. We have Ozai, also obsessed with keeping power. He was going to wipe out the entire Earth Kingdom just because they were resisting him. Mm-hmm. We have King Kue of the Earth Kingdom, who never ventured out of the upper ring of Ba Sing Se, didn't know that there was a war outside the city. And when the capital finally fell to Azula, he took Bosco and decided he was going to travel the world rather than helping to liberate his people. We have his daughter, Queen Huting, who is so corrupt that she's overtaxing and stealing from her own people and forcing the new airbenders into her military against her will. We have Unalaq, who invaded the Southern Water Tribe and attempted to become the Dark Avatar by unleashing the power of Vatu on the world. So these are just some, just a few, of the most recent world leaders in this universe. And the consequences of their actions not only have put balance in the world into jeopardy, but have also created massive distrust amongst the citizens of the world. Consider yourself a citizen of any of these nations. How can you continue to trust in governments and institutions that don't appear to serve you, but appear only interested in suppressing you and expanding their own power? It is for this reason that people are vulnerable to the messaging of the Red Lotus. Zaheer believes that people can no longer count on governments of any of the four nations and must fend for themselves. But his message is pretty short-sighted. If the natural order is disorder, then the strong will prey on the weak. And in my opinion, Bender supremacy would take hold again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, this is so relevant in our world right now. Like, mm-hmm. when you think about the different leaders we've had, and good and bad, whatever it is, and then you think about the real uptick in conspiracy theories and silos of information and people being vulnerable to this kind of like thinking, because somewhere there's a failure in showing up for the people. And this is where I think Avatar really shines, because this is, if you go back through the history of this world, even beyond a lot of things, you'll see that this is a running theme about government not functioning for the people, and that the Avatar having a place there, but also the people needing liberation. And I think think about it. I mean, what are the impacts? We think about it and we say it in this show because it's a kid's show, and just kind of go over it. But think about war. Like, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years. Like, multiply that by five And that's how long this world was in that kind of level of turmoil. And there, of course, it's going to have all these issues, all the things that we're talking about. Of course, there's going to be corruption. Of course, there's going to be like these, like, you know, people who get, who have the tons of loss and lost life and silo, like power vacuums. It's amazing the way that they're capturing this. Families that are like unstable. Like, it's amazing how they're capturing this.
And families that don't always agree on which side to be on, right? We see Tonrock and his brother come to blows over this. They don't agree on how to rule, and they don't even agree, they don't even have the same philosophy on what ruling means. It's just it's an interesting theme, and if you really think about what is the purpose of the Avatar, which you know, without spoiling it, is going to be one of the questions that the show poses in book four. But if you really think deeply about what the purpose of the Avatar is, we focused a lot in book two on the connection to the spiritual world. But really, what kept Aang the most busy and what keeps Korra the most busy are the human problems. It's the issue with what people with power will do when they have that power and when they can exploit it. And so I thought that, you know, when you hear Zaheer speak, a lot of what he says is true, and it resonates in a lot of ways, especially with those of us who are frustrated a lot of the time with government. But we've heard many dictators use similar words to get power. And so it really falls on government to continue to shore up trust amongst people, to be transparent, to deliver basic needs, functioning roads, you know, things like that, not to overtax people so that people don't fall for these kinds of arguments all the time.
Agreed. I mean, this is like, I mean, not to get so deep into our world, but I mean, I don't know. I've watched, we've talked about this offline, but like, you know, even like the stuff with all the stuff we see about Q this and this thing, and or this conspiracy theory or this like YouTube video or whatever it is, this stuff is like, it's out here, and it can, and people can become susceptible to all of these things based on, you know, what you just spoke about. I definitely feel like one of the things that's really interesting to me about Zaheer's take about the White Lotus is that, as I was thinking about this just sitting here now, I mean, the White Lotus is such an ancient organization. It's not like it popped up around Aang's time and the 100 years. I mean, we're talking about Kaioshi time and before that the White Lotus existed, right? Probably even before that. So, like, that's a long time for an organization to be functioning, to decide that, oh, because they decided that in a time of crisis to save and come to the aid of the one person who they thought could bring something back to balance. I think, like, you gotta call into question Zaheer's motives, because it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make a lot of, it doesn't add up, you know? So
yeah, and the means do matter, right? Like, Zaheer is willing to kill people to get what he wants, and that it's not just like, oh well, these are the means to the end. The means matter. Like, how you get to the end is also important. Like, he demonstrated to the people of Ba Sing Se that taking down the tyranny had to be done violently. Of course the city falls into chaos. There's no peaceful transfer of power. There's no power at all. It's just whoever can be the most violent, take the most resources, they're the ones who are going to rule, because that's in his mind that, you know, the disorder should eventually lead to some kind of order. But what it really does is it creates more human suffering.
Yeah. And I'm really interested, and this gives nothing away, because I'm really interested in where the creators go with this kind of thinking in general in this world. And again, going back to what their thoughts are around leaders and rulers, just because, like, we all know that I wouldn't say the longest ever, but to date, the avatars that we know, Kaioshi lived the longest and was the avatar the longest, like 200 plus years, 240 years, something like that. And what I find fascinating, why I'm bringing that up, is because she's one of the few avatars that had connections in multiple different pockets of society. It wasn't just Team Avatar and, like, you know, the quote-unquote good guys. She, the gamut of, like, places that she was, like, involved in. And she ended up being the avatar for the longest. So what are they saying about corruption? I'm still not clear what the creators are trying to say about imperialism and corruption and these things. And I would like this to get more clear in their later work. I'd like for it to be a little bit more clear. It's, you know, it's like, you don't want it to be a nihilistic kind of point of view. You want them to get to a point where it feels, and of course they don't. They land on, like, a lot of times, well, good triumphs, but I would like to see what they're trying to make the point about by this being so present in the world all the time.
Yeah, and I think it's fine for a show to not necessarily even have a thesis about what should be, because I think that the world is a chaotic place, and none of this, there's nothing on this show, you know, that feels incredibly unrealistic when it comes to this question of leadership.
No.
I think a lot of it is based in reality, but I would like to get a sense from them of what are they trying to say about the like, what is right here? Because I guess my frustration is, and this is a criticism many people have had of Korra, that Atla had a very anti-imperialist message, but then Korra sometimes muddles the message a little bit because there are points where it seems like imperialism or in like monarchies and also capitalism are just fine. So I would just love to see, like, what's your thesis here, guys? Like, I think it's fine that the thesis is, like, the world is a messy, complete place. There's lots of things to fight, especially when it comes to justice. But I'd just like to know what their thoughts on, like, what is just?
Yeah.
What is a just society here?
Yeah, what philosophy are they writing, thinking about? I think that, too. And I would say, though, 3 is my favorite season of this show. I do like 4 as well. And what I would say is, one of the things getting super meta that I think is the reason is because at this point in the series, Nickelodeon decided that they were going to have 2 seasons. And this season feels like they hit their stride again of planting little Easter eggs of things that had a longer shelf life. And I just wish that would have been the decision from the beginning. Hey, we're going to do 4 seasons, guys. And then I think that things would have felt a little bit more cohesive, because this feels like everybody has something to do. The stakes are super relevant. And I think that things, you know, there's a reason why these things are happening that are going to impact not only this season, but next season too, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally agree.
Well, cool.
I really do.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah. Thank you for rocking with us. We are going right through this thing. Man, crazy. We're already gotten all the way through episode 10 of book 3. So, we would love to hear from you. Hit us up in our social on Twitter, Instagram, KinFolklorePod, or also KinFolklorePodcast on Facebook. Join our Facebook group. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.